Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A trillion here, a trillion there. Pretty soon you're talking real money, folks. What's in store for the Super Committee? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Glad you could be with us on this Friday, everybody. It's the 28th of October today. These are not the best of times to be a member of the United States Congress. Just 13% of us approve of our duly elected representatives. But it's arguably an even worse time to be a member of the Congressional Super Committee, the dozen lawmakers who've got the unenviable task of cutting the deficit by $1.2 trillion and doing it by Thanksgiving. They're being hounded by lobbyists, their own party leaders and colleagues, and now the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, and a bipartisan group of others who are saying just $1.2 trillion? Bloomberg and the rest want a much bigger package, maybe $3 or $4 trillion in cuts. The National Journal reports that Bloomberg's hosting a Go Big dinner party this weekend as Washington comes to terms with a new economic term. Marketplace's David Gura has the story.
You want to know what's all the rage in Washington? It's austerity.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's an absolute obsession.
That's economist Dean Baker. He hasn't bought into the Go Big hype some lawmakers and pundits have. You won't see him in one of their videos.
As far as I'm concerned, we have to have a go-big approach to this particular problem.
I believe that this committee ought to go big.
I think there's no substitute for a go-big approach.
We absolutely do need to go big because the problems that we're facing on our deficit are big.
Last month, 60 people wrote a letter to the Super Committee saying we have to bring down the deficit now, that entitlement programs are unsustainable, and our credit rating is on the line. Baker says, hold on a sec. First, the government should spend to create jobs and fix our short-term problem. Then it can deal with the deficit. Bob Bixby disagrees. As head of the Concord Coalition, he's been sounding the alarm about the deficit for decades.
I think you can walk and chew gum at the same time when it comes to the budget.
Bixby signed that letter to the Super Committee.
It is entirely consistent to be talking about measures that will help the economy in the short term, or at least not harm it, while at the same time enacting long-term deficit reduction measures.
The trouble is, that sounds contradictory. Jim Kessler is with Third Way, a centrist think tank.
Boy, that's a hard message to sell. Like, we need to really reduce the deficit, but we got to spend more right now.
Kessler says he believes that you can do both, but Congress isn't getting that nuance. The message is go big or go home. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
So there's austerity brewing in Washington, but American consumers are spending. Personal consumption expenditures, that's Commerce Department speak for consumer spending, were up in September for the second month in a row. So could that be, at long last, the sound of a growing economy that'll finally start humming along? Yeah, well, that's where the political economy of Washington that David Gura was just talking about hits the personal economy of our wallets. Here's Marketplace's Eve Troeh.
Consumer spending rose 0.6% in September. People didn't just spend because they were making a tiny bit more money. They dipped into savings to buy some new clothes or a new car. And that can be a powerful force.
The last few recessions, the consumer is really what rallied, what basically led the economy back into recovery.
Beth Ann Bovino is deputy chief economist at Standard & Poor's.
This time around, they're not doing it. And that's why economists and businesses are scared.
2 months of consumer spending growth at less than 1% won't drag the economy out of the hole. Bovino says consumers would have to dig deeper into savings for many more months for that. And news of major spending cuts in Washington gets people nervous about their finances.
Some of those benefits that I get from the government might be taken away. That means less spending for me.
But Stuart Hoffman at PNC Financial says lately consumer confidence and spending don't match up.
Watch what consumers do, not what they say, and they're acting a lot better than they're feeling.
Hoffman says one way to boost consumers' moods would be for the Washington Super Committee to deliver a bipartisan spending plan, any size plan, before their Thanksgiving deadline.
And I think the beneficial effects to consumer confidence and to the markets would at least initially outweigh any negative effects over time.
Consumers will have years to absorb those deep government cuts, he says. And knowing that, they may feel more comfortable spending just in time for holiday shopping. I'm Eve Troeh for Marketplace.
Last month, when Bank of America announced that $5 debit card fee, a whole lot of people were really, really peeved. Banks are kind of used to ignoring outrage and doing whatever they want, but this time it actually seemed to work. Not with B of A, so far at least, but some big rivals are now saying they are not going to charge that fee. It's a win for consumers, right? Yeah, not quite. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has the story.
Louis Casals is a New Yorker who banks with Chase. When the news came out today that Chase won't charge a $5 debit card fee, he was pretty pleased. This is a victory for the little guy, right?
I think it's nice that Chase don't charge you the fee on the debit card because there's enough bills out there.
But Louis probably isn't getting off scot-free. Sure, he and other Chase customers don't pay a debit card fee, but the small print shows they pay a $12 a month charge if they don't keep a minimum balance of $1,500. Bart Narder is an analyst with Celent.
They're going to have to put the fees on something else. They have to.
Citibank, for instance, skipped the debit fee, but at the same time said it would hike the monthly maintenance charges on checking accounts.
They're doing this in order to make checking accounts a viable business because banks are losing money on at least half of all accounts.
But Norma Garcia, a senior attorney with the Consumers Union, still calls it a win. She says the move
really speaks volumes to the power of consumers lending their voice to shutting down what they think is an unjust fee.
Garcia says consumers will have to remain vigilant as banks slip in more fees. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Traders took this Friday to catch their breath, more losers than winners on a day the major indices finished mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We have arrived, mercifully, at the end of the week, which means two things. One, it's going to be really nice to sleep in tomorrow. And B, we're going to spend the next 4 minutes of this broadcast trying to figure out what happened in the 5 days gone by. To do that, we've got Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal with us, also Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so we start where the week began, I think, probably in Europe, Cardiff, right? And the question is, we've got a deal. How long till it all goes kerflooey?
I don't know if it's all going to go kerflooey, but the problem is that there's just a staggering number of unanswered questions here. And so, markets rallied on it, but so what? Markets can be pretty silly sometimes. We don't know, for instance, how are bondholders of Greek debt going to be forced to take this haircut? Are banks going to be able to raise the capital they were asked to raise? What shape is this bailout facility actually going to eventually take? And that's before getting into even bigger issues of European fiscal integration and the role of the European Central Bank and things like that. So to be perfectly honest, I think the best thing you can say about this deal is that it wasn't a step back, but neither was it too much of a step forward. We just only got the skeletons of a deal now, and it needs to be fleshed out. So, yeah, this thing ain't over yet, and we'll probably be back talking about this very soon.
Lovely. Sudeep, what do you think of my kerflooey theory, that it all just falls apart?
It certainly seems like we go through this cycle. This was the summit to end all summits, which came after 3 months after the last summit to end all summits. Yeah. And I'll go out on a limb and say maybe January 24th is when we'll have our next big crisis. We'll just put it at that point.
Oh, the problem is there something happening that day, or is that just 3 months?
That's just three months from now. Right. And we seem to keep going through this same problem of they've become very good at kicking the can down the road. Almost all politicians have around the world. And all the hard problems have been deferred to be discussed later, and this market rally will fade, and we'll come to the point where everyone realizes they just didn't get very much out of this summit.
Cardiff, you talked about that 50% haircut that banks are going to take over there, the 50% not payment that they're going to get on their debt. What induces a bank to take that kind of loss? Just the prospect of disaster?
Yeah, I mean, the prospect that things will be even worse. And also, I think there's going to be some not too subtle political pressure to accept it. But in the end, I'm very dubious about exactly how that's going to play out. But if you want to talk about the problem within the banks there, I mean, something that would have really helped them is if the sovereign debt situation would be cleared up a little bit. And we still need to find out, for instance, what Spain and Italy are going to do about their own reform plans. We still need to know, again, exactly what the ECB is going to eventually do.
Yeah,
it's tried to get aggressive
there,
in the past, and it runs into institutional resistance. So, I just don't know what's happening. And to be honest, I'll take the under on Sudeep's January 24th date.
We're going to have a meeting before that? Yeah. All right, so Sudeep, Cardiff was talking about being dubious as to the prospects. Let me turn that to the Super Committee and the odds that in a month they're going to find $1.2 trillion to get out of the budget in the next 10 years?
Well, in this case, we've already started lowering all of our expectations and expecting failure. So maybe they'll come up with something that's a little bit short of failure and make people feel a little bit better. But it just doesn't seem likely that within a year of an election, we're going to get some big deal that's going to make everyone happy and everyone more hopeful about the state of politics and the state of our economic policy making and the state of the economy. And so the hope here really needs to be tamed a little bit.
I need you to say that thing you just said again. So it's going to be a little bit short of failure, and we're going to call that a win?
That is that seems to be the new way of thinking about policy these days.
So, Cardiff, what happens if the super committee doesn't make a deal? I mean, there's that automatic cuts trigger for $1.5 trillion, but come on, really?
Yeah, I don't entirely buy that either. Remember that these cuts are going to take shape until the end of next year, and by then there'll be time to make changes to it. So, who knows? I think this just goes to show that nothing's really changed, and it's a bad sign that we're actually starting to get leaks from what's happening inside the committee. It means that everybody's disagreeing and they're starting to position themselves politically. So,
right. Yeah,
sorry, I'm like Sudeep. I'm lowering the expectations bar to within inches above the ground. So if they step over it, I guess we'll all be happy, but it doesn't mean it's a good thing.
You guys are killing me. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Sudeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks a lot, you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks, Scott.
A lot of our coverage of the Greek debt crisis this week has been big picture, macro in the economic sense, trying to explain why we ought to care. On the ground in Greece, though, it's a lot more personal. It's individual, because that's where the crisis is being felt. Unemployment, for just one indicator, is 16% in Greece, and the search for work has a lot of Greeks looking to work someplace else. Theodora Economides is one of those people. We've called her up in Athens. Theodora, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Why are you leaving Greece?
I'm leaving Greece because I've been unemployed for a year and a half, and I haven't had paid employment for 2 years. So I don't really have a choice. I need to have a job.
And where are you going to go?
I work in education in emergencies, so I will be going back to my old job, which is education programs for refugees and displaced people, and that's going to be in Kenya and the three areas of Somalia.
This is going to sound funny when I ask it, but Somalia is a war zone, you know.
I know, it sounds nuts. That's what I know how to do.
So you know what you're doing over there.
Yes, but at least I'm going to have an interesting job there.
Yeah, if you could find a job in Greece, would you stay, or is the economy just so bad?
I would stay. If I could find a decent job here, I'm not talking about a well-paid job, because that doesn't exist, but a job that is paid, I would stay.
Tell me about your friends and whatever colleagues you might have had. I mean, how do they feel?
Everybody thinks that the situation is very bad, that economically, of course, it's awful, but also politically and socially. Today is a national holiday in Greece. And this is the anniversary of the day Greece said no to Mussolini at the beginning of World War II. Mm-hmm. And we celebrate this as the anniversary of the day we said no. So today, where there are supposed to be parades in every city of Greece, there were protests all over the country with people who had banners saying no, and the no was meant for the government and its policies.
You know, people are going to hear this interview and they're going to say, well, what do the Greek people expect to have happen? You have to have spending cuts when you can't pay the bills.
What the Greek people can tell the rest of the world for a fact is that spending cuts is not helping anyone pay the bill. Because we're not producing anything, we have 16% unemployment, we're not consuming either, so the entire economy is collapsing, and that is not helping us pay the bill.
Theodora Economides, leaving Greece for Kenya and Somalia, because she can't find a job. Theodora, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, when time really is money.
He wakes up with less than a day every day, and if he doesn't go to work, he dies. He will literally time out.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors caught their breath the day after Thursday's rally. The Dow Industrials seesawed its way to a gain of 22 points, nearly 0.2%, closed at 12,231. The NASDAQ slipped a point. We'll call that, basically flat. Finished at 2737. The S&P 500 ended things flat as well, 1,285. For the week, the Dow picked up 3.6%. The NASDAQ added 3.8%. The S&P 500 split the difference, rose 3.7%. Improving consumer sentiment numbers and positive earnings fueled today's winner. Stillwater Mining, a Montana company that digs up platinum, reported a sevenfold increase in profits as shares shined up 18% on this Friday. Goodyear gained 4.9% after reporting that its tires fetched higher prices last quarter. Blue chip Hewlett-Packard picked up 3.5% a day after it reversed a plan to spin off its personal computer business. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.32%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The United Nations Committee Against Torture meets in Geneva for its 47th session. MTV holds the O Music Awards. It's a digital thing. And all that candy that's been circulating should be used up by the end of the day. Give it away. It's Halloween. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. If you're a baseball fan, you already know all about Game 6 of the World Series last night. If you're not a fan and you somehow don't know what happened, suffice it to say it was a game for the ages. The 47,000-some-odd people in a packed Busch Stadium in St. Louis clearly got their money's worth. And you can make a case that St. Louis did, too, because back when the stadium was being built in 2005, the city put up only a fraction of the cost. Commentator John Wertheim says that's the wave of the future.
Leather football helmets, wooden tennis rackets, boxing on network television. The sports world has a singular knack for generating relics. And here it seems is another, the taxpayer-funded venue. For decades, the owners of pro sports teams, wealthy men and corporations, could rely on the local populace to help underwrite the cost of their buildings. In most major markets, even some minor ones, stadiums and arenas were built largely through the largesse of the local tax base. Now, that game is over. The voters of Seattle may have started this trend. In 2006, they declined to subsidize a new basketball arena for the Sonics, though that meant losing the team to Oklahoma City. In Minneapolis, the NFL's Vikings are currently facing widespread opposition to the latest plan for a massive taxpayer-funded stadium. In Los Angeles, developers hoping to lure an NFL team have already promised that for a proposed billion-dollar stadium, quote, the city's never going to have to pay a penny. Some of this is a function of these austere times. What's more, the economic impact from previous projects are at best inconclusive. Yes, these facilities create jobs, but they're mostly seasonal and low-paying. It's also become clear that dazzling stadiums don't draw fans. Dazzling teams do. A decade ago, the Milwaukee Brewers christened Miller Park, a half-billion-dollar construction project, most of it provided by generous, if unwittingly generous, Wisconsinites. Attendance surged when the park opened, but the team lost games and attendance plummeted by as much as 50%. This season, the Brewers, a top team, drew more than 3 million fans. The moral? Build a winning team and they'll come. For years, owners got their way mostly by pitting one market against another, preying on civic insecurities. If you don't give me what I want, I might be forced to relocate my team to a city with more appreciative fans. Now, though, the cleat is on the other foot. It's the taxpayers pitting owners against owners. If teams in other cities can build their pavilions without public help, they ask, why can't you?
John Wertheim is a senior writer at Sports Illustrated. You can send us your thoughts. Online is best. Marketplace.org is the website. Imagine, if you can, a world without money. Or more accurately, where money has been replaced by time. What you get then, logically, is a world where the poor literally live day to day. The only way they get more time is by working and earning it. And the rich can live, theoretically, forever. That's the premise of Andrew Nichols' new film. It's called In Time. Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
This is, not to be too trite about it, but time is money, right?
Yes, time is literally the currency in this movie.
Where'd you get the idea? Where'd that come from?
It comes out of Gattaca, a movie I made a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew then that the holy grail of genetic engineering was to switch off the aging gene. If you can switch off the aging gene, and theoretically everyone can live forever, you have to find a way of avoiding massive overpopulation. So they came up with a body clock in my society where we can trade time. You earn time and you spend time.
One of the trailers I saw for this had a guy going into a coffee shop, and he, you know, the cup of coffee costs whatever it is, 14 seconds more now than it did.
Four minutes.
Yeah, and the coffee shop guy says, "Yeah, you don't want it tough. Don't buy it."
Right, and of course, if you come from a poor time zone in this society, if you run to that coffee shop, you can maybe get two cups of coffee, but if you walk, you can only get one because your life is literally ticking away.
That's actually very interesting because it's very current now, right? It's we are the 99%. It's the top 1%. It's Occupy Wall Street. There's a very current vibe going on that I'm not sure you were thinking about 2.5 years ago when you made this movie.
No, it's proved to be very timely. But as soon as you make the decision that time is currency, then you have to base it on, you know, the economic times of today.
Let's play a cut from the film. It's Justin Timberlake's character, a guy by the name of Will Salas, running into a guy who's got more than a century of time built up. And he saves him from a gang of thieves who call themselves the Minutemen. Let's play the tape.
For a few to be immortal, many must die.
What the hell's that supposed to mean?
You really don't know, do you? Everyone can't live forever. Where would we put them? Why do you think taxes and prices go up the same day in the ghetto? The cost of living keeps rising to make sure people keep dying. How else could there be men with a million years while most live day to day? But the truth is, there's more than enough.
Timberlake's character, Will Salas, doesn't make a whole lot of money. He's got usually, I think, if I remember right, less than a day on that clock on his arm thing.
Right, yeah, he wakes up with less than a day every day, and if he doesn't go to work, he dies. He will literally time out.
It gives living paycheck to paycheck a whole new meaning.
Yeah, it's also sort of the perfect metaphor for living in the moment because you are watching your seconds drain away. So you are more conscious of what you're doing.
Not only is it current with the Occupy Wall Streets and the haves and the have-nots, but it's very, you know, this thing that's been happening in this society for the past 15, 20 years of getting busier and busier and not having enough time to do everything that society demands of you today, whether it's work or pleasure or family or just being, you know?
Yeah, no, we've become very ADD. And so much so that, in fact, the body clock that everyone has in this movie that's genetically encoded, I had to speed up seconds at some point in the movie because when there's a shot of the clock, not enough seconds elapse quickly enough because a second seems to take an awful long time to people in our society. So I actually had to speed up time, so which proves how ADD we are.
Yeah. And actually, in this film, ADD can be fatal, right? Because if you're not paying attention, you're going to run out of time.
Yeah, you've got to watch the clock.
Andrew Nichol, his most recent film is called In Time. Andrew, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, a chance on the last Friday of the month to take a break from the headlines and catch up on the news that didn't quite make it into the front pages, comes to us the same way it always does, courtesy of Brendan Francis Noonan, Rico Galliano, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Ethan Lindsay, producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The Jersey Shore.
Yeah, what else is new?
Yeah, exactly. Every weekend. But this weekend, there's an academic conference at the University of Chicago studying the Jersey Shore. I have the conference program. It's very official right here with me.
Wait a minute. Have we run out of things like science or math to talk about? Or just non-trashy TV shows. There are plenty of those.
But we're focusing on Jersey Shore now.
All right, what's at the conference?
The keynote speaker's a professor, and she's talking about the monetization of being, reputational labor, brand culture, and why Jersey Shore matters.
Does it say if they'll be hot tubbing at the reception afterwards?
I wonder who's going to be attending this conference, because they're going to all be at the clubs.
Avishai Artsy, assistant producer for Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Something called the Maple Act.
The Maple? What is the Maple Act?
Well, Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont is very concerned that people are selling counterfeit maple syrup, and he wants to make it a federal felony to do that.
A federal offense?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from New Hampshire, and we take our maple syrup really seriously up there.
Serious enough to put Mrs. Butterworth behind bars? That's outrageous.
She does have sticky fingers.
Oh, that should be a felony.
Jennifer Collins, reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
There's this historic bridge in Kentucky. Officials want to replace it, but they don't want to destroy it because it's historic. So they're giving it away.
For free?
For free to anybody. They'll give it to like a regular person, to an institution, to pretty much anyone.
Has Alaska shown any interest? They have the bridge to nowhere. They could start a collection.
There's plenty more where that came from. The radio show Rico and Brendan do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link to the podcast on our website, marketplace.org. And that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 22 points, nearly 0.2%. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 both pretty much ended right where they began. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, get sick, go broke.
Millions of people, they may not know this, but they are just one accident away from disaster.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend. We'll meet you back here on Monday. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.